tonight on Arena. John McGuire on Sonny Boy, the new memoir from Al Pacino, and Jack Fennell on Your Own Dark Shadow, his anthology of lost Irish horror stories. Five one double 51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTD Arena, and you can watch us on rte.ie/arena. It's now more than 50 years since Al Pacino first exploded onto our cinema screens with that great run of films in the 1970s, including The Godfather Parts 1 and 2, Serpico and Dog Day Afternoon. His Michael Corleone alone showed the range of the actor, the reluctant heir to the mafia family business, going on to become a stone-cold killer, is a chilling transformation. Unforgettable masterclass in the art of screen acting. At 84, Pacino remains as compelling a figure as ever, on screen and off, and he's telling his own story in this memoir, Sonny Boy. Joe McGuire, regular Frimmer critic with us, has been reading it, yeah. And he's with me now in studio. I mean, when you kind of, even if you just listed off the films that
we could literally just read the Wikipedia page, Sean, yeah. And we'd be happy because
it's an extraordinary back catalogue, isn't it?
It is, really. And you look through, he's one of the most influential actors, not only for his own achievements on screen, but the influence that he had on other actors. All throughout the 70s, the 80s and the 90s. Not so much in the 80s, we might get to that. Mm. Up to today, I mean, he's still working. He was absolutely magnetic in Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. He talks a bit about Tarantino. He talks a lot about the directors that he's worked with and the other actors that he's worked with in this book, and he's full of compliments. But it's curious as you read it that he is just as... looking back, he is just as tender, really, about the films that didn't work as he is about the films that did. Particularly Hugh Hudson's Revolution, which is a film he made in the 1980s, when he was deep in the throes of alcoholism and really struggling to find work that fulfilled him in some way. And he's really complimentary about it. He actually is one of the few films that he comes back to later that was, you know, remastered and shown again after 30 years or whatever. And he comes back, he goes to a screening of it. He never watches his own films, apparently. Goes to it. And it's that's really tender in this book, I've found, is that it's the misses that he likes as much as the hits. Now, we can ream off the hits, and there's plenty of them.
Yeah, well, I suppose The Godfather is going to be right at the very top of that list, isn't it?
And it's Serpico. Really... it's a book about the things that meant the most to him along the way in that 50 years. Now, we start... incidentally, when my wife saw me reading this book, she was like, how much of it is in all capital letters? Because you expect it to be this big operatic boom.
Yeah.
And it's not that. It's quiet. It's a tender, like, I keep saying the word tender because it is that.
Yeah,
sensitive book.
From looking at bits of it during the day today, I felt as if he was speaking directly to me. I saw him interviewed about this particular memoir, and he was very open about all aspects of
his life. Well, it's all come out, you see, because throughout his career, he was very private. Mm. We'll repeat some of the stories about The Godfather, the making of Dog Day Afternoon. But he never really talked about his personal life. He never really talked about his childhood. He had an incredibly difficult childhood.
Sonny Boy, the title of the memoir.
Mother's nickname for him, yeah, when he was a child.
His mother who died when he was quite young.
She first attempted suicide when he was a teenager. And later then, I think he was 22, when he calls it an accidental overdose. But, you know, we don't know. And at that point, she had raised him. His grandparents had raised him. They're the people who made him, you know, kept him alive, really, in the Bronx in the
50s. Were they poor? Was it a tough...
It was a tough upbringing, yeah. He's very clear. Now, the first 100 pages or so of this 350-page book are about his childhood. And then the last chapter, he returns to his childhood again. And it's had a massive impact on him. And as it did, a lot of those actors that came up in the 60s and 70s, coming out of the post-war, particularly in New York, it was a hard go.
How difficult was the childhood in terms of education, in terms of the sort of the gang?
He has his little neighbourhood gang, Cliffy and Petey and all these guys, all of whom died before the age of 30 of heroin overdoses. He credits his grandmother on his mother's side with saving him from that life, from a street life. But he's still very much a street actor even now. You know, there's still an element of danger to him and an element of that kind of street-level opera to him. But when he's talking about his childhood, he's not hammering the poverty thing. That is just really the way it was. It's when he left school and started acting. He had done school performances, started acting and trying to get a job as an actor. It's that period in his early 20s, up until the age of 28, 29, when he was essentially homeless and a bum living in New York, trying to scratch a living, doing odd jobs. That whole section of the book is really illuminating. And there's a lot of echoes. He finds echoes in a lot of things. A pearl-handled gun that his father had. He didn't really know his father. He used the same gun then when he came to play Vincent Hanna in Heat for Michael Mann. Corleone in The Godfather. He discovered, on the set of The Godfather, that his own grandfather had come from the village of Corleone in Sicily. And you find all of these echoes, and you get the sense that he's looking for them.
But I did wonder about those echoes and that kind of structure, whether that is part of it. There is a co-writer here, but it very much sounds like Al Pacino talking directly to you, very conversational style of writing.
Yeah.
But I wonder, was the structure maybe that might be a finesse to it that you don't
necessarily expect from somebody as explosive as Pacino. But it's co-written by a guy called David Iskoff, who's a former culture reporter for the New York Times. And he's written a couple of other books. He wrote a great biography of Robin Williams and a superbly precise making of the film Network, Paddy Chayefsky's Network. And I don't know. Like I say, when you read this book, if somehow you'd gotten this far, Sean, and you'd never seen an Al Pacino movie, you'd never seen him on TV, you didn't know who he was, I think you'd get a very clear and precise idea of the kind of actor he is just from what he's written here.
And not only what's most striking about the way he's talking in the book, he really gets in underneath the skin of the craft. A lot of actors, when they go to talk about the craft of acting, clam up and say...
They say the same thing over and over again.
I don't want to ruin the magic, or I don't know what I'm doing. It's my instinct or whatever. That type of response. But he really gets in underneath it. Much has that got to do with, I suppose, that period in New York, Lee Strasberg, the Actors Studio, all of that.
He was a student at the Actors Studio. Mm. He did work with Lee Strasberg. He made a couple of films with Lee Strasberg. Strasberg is in The Godfather, for instance. He made a couple of films with them. The Actors Studio and the Stella Adler Studio. I think that there was that working class New York school, which was very, very different to the LA school. Pacino was terrified of Hollywood. Refused to attend his first Oscars for when he was nominated for The Godfather, and was very reluctant to attend the Oscars again. He's had 9 nominations and he's won one. And I think he was afraid of Hollywood. I think he was afraid of money. He's very, very poor with money. He was advised and then poorly advised. He went bust a couple of times. And I think he was also terrified of fame. After The Godfather, people would come up to him in the street and start quoting lines from the movie to him. And he just couldn't handle that.
Where did The Godfather come? I mean, what had he established at the point?
Nothing. Virtually nothing. He made a film called The Panic in Needle Park, which was fairly well received. Francis Ford Coppola had seen that, rang him and said, "I've got The Godfather," which Pacino couldn't believe. He had won a Tony now up to this. Sorry, I missed that. That's kind
of
important.
He had a bit of theatre experience.
He had won a Tony, and he had won an Obie Award, which is just as significant at that time in New York for Broadway performances. Coppola rang him and said, I'm offering you the part. No audition, no screen test, no chemistry test, no read. Don't come out.
Yeah.
We're offering you the part. And he couldn't believe me. He thought it was a gag. And I think that break... Now, later... That became a burden. But at that point, this was the role everybody wanted.
Yeah, let's stick with The Godfather for the time being. Go on to listen to a clip. Robert Duvall here as the consigliere to the Corleones, Tom Hagen, isn't it? He's just explained about the killing of cops and how that's not really on. And then the whole idea is they have to protect the life of Don Vito, Marlon Brando, of course. But Pacino's Mikey, who's the college kid of the family, who's kind of trying to stay away from all of this, then makes the case for the killing of McCluskey, the cop in question.
Hey, what are you going to do? Nice college boy, huh? Didn't want to get mixed up in the family business? Now you want to gun down a police captain? Why, because he slapped you in the face a little bit? Huh? What do you think, this is the army where you shoot him a mile away? You gotta get up close like this, and bada-bing, you blow their brains all over your nice Ivy League suit. Come in. Mwah! You're taking this very personal. Tom, this is business, and this man is taking it very, very personal.
Where does it say that you can't kill a cop?
Come on, Mikey.
Tom, wait a minute. I'm talking about a cop that's mixed up in drugs. I'm talking about a dishonest cop, a crooked cop who got mixed up in the rackets and got what was coming to him. That's a terrific story. And we have newspaper people on the payroll, don't we, Tom? They might like a story like that.
They might. They just might.
It's not personal, Sonny. It's strictly business.
Yeah, great line.
The coldness of that, the coolness of that. Al Pacino as Mikey in The Godfather. And we also heard the voices of Robert Duvall as Tom Hagen in there, and James Caan as the brother, Sonny Corleone. John McGuire with me in studio this evening talking about the new memoir as it's been published, Sonny Boy, Memoir of Al Pacino. And given the success of that movie and all the things that you were saying, I mean, it did shoot him to international stardom, not just American stardom. It wasn't the happiest experience on set.
No, there was a lot of conflict. Pacino had, you know, free rein, really. He was the director's pick. Paramount did not want him. They wanted, you know, Robert Redford or Warren Beatty or Jack Nicholson or somebody who was already established. And Pacino had this notion that he would play the first half of the film, essentially the first half of the film, as this quiet, reserved prince in waiting, who was just an observer and just not involved necessarily, a war hero, not involved in the family business. And it was that scene that they're just about to discuss there, the murder of the drug dealer Colazzo and the corrupt cop McCluskey in the restaurant where he goes and gets the gun from behind the loo. That's the scene. He wanted to wait basically until that scene was shot so that he would become Michael Corleone. But Coppola didn't know much about this. There was regular discussions and a lot of conflict, and the studio were leaning on Coppola to just get rid of this guy and start over.
In fact, he has that picture, is one of the pictures that's in the middle of the book.
That's right.
Holding the gun. And I think he says the gun, or the scene that saved my life, really.
Saved his career, because they would have sacked him, and that might have been the end of Pacino. And can you imagine, you know, he says in the book that there'd be no Pacino without The Godfather. But for the actor delivering the performance of a lifetime in only his second film, that brought its own burdens. He'd learn later, you know, the alcoholism, the pressure of fame, this attention that he just wasn't used to.
He goes into the detail of films along the way here as well. You were saying, I think, that he's particularly good on Scarface.
He is, yes. Now, Scarface was a film that horrified people at the time. It's relatively tame today. It still has a lot of power to it. But at the time, people were absolutely horrified by the film. And people who were close to him were advising him, what were you doing, Al? What made you make this film with, you know... It took a while for the film to be recognised as a classic. And he talks a lot about how it was embraced by the hip-hop community. It's quite scattered at times. You know, you have to try to keep up with him. There are, you know, narrative leaps, thematic leaps that you have to go with him. You have to trust him enough to take him with you. But he's also very detailed on Dog Day Afternoon, which is, I think, one of his best films. And his friendship with John Cazale, the tragic story of John Cazale, who in general was one of the greatest actors of that time, any time really. And he says that he learned so much from him. They had done theatre together. They made three films together, and he was inspired by him. And, you know, Cazale really is a very important actor at that time. And you can see after Cazale's early death that how Pacino took on some of that kind of sensitivity that he hadn't had before.
And the other thing that he really goes into in detail here is a great picture of him as Richard III, and he takes the mickey out of himself saying because it's a little bit hand on chin pose type of thing going on here. But he's very open and, it seems to me, very tender and loving about his stage performances.
He is, and why not? He is devoted to Shakespeare. There's a lot of Shakespeare references in this book. He mentioned Shakespeare time and again. He made the film with his own money, looking for Richard, which... you know, nobody went to see. Nobody was interested in at all, except for, you know, a small handful of people. And he literally names them in the film as the people who went to see the movie, because so few people saw it. But he did Shakespeare in the Park for free. He's currently working with the British director Bernard Rose on an adaptation of King Lear, an experimental at 84 years of age, an experimental King Lear. I mean...
I remember seeing another documentary about Salome that he did on stage with Jessica Chastain as Salome.
Yeah, and that was a film as well, a kind of a documentary.
It was a documentary on the making of it. But him on stage, extraordinary to see it, like phenomenal power.
Yeah, and you can see we can watch the films, we can't look back at the stage performances, but there was a couple, An Indian Looks for the Bronx and The Tiger Wears a Tie. Those kind of experimental plays from the late 60s. He, When he talks about them, you can almost see them. You really get a sense of how sweaty it was, how hard he worked, and how little reward he was getting for it at the time. That craft, that work, that dedication, the text, he's very interested in text. He turned down multiple roles because he just didn't buy the stories. Then he went broke, Sean.
And he did.
And then he just took whatever was in front of him.
Whatever came his way.
There's a lot of that, too, about his private life, which he just never talked about before.
Well, I'll come back to the private life in a minute. I just want to go back to one of the films. Where does Scent of a Woman fit into all of this?
I think at the time, if this book has a bad guy or a villain, it is Hollywood and it's the Academy Award. And he was nominated for 8 of them before he won for Scent of a Woman. Now, Scent of a Woman came in 1989, I believe, at a time when he hadn't done a huge amount of work. Sea of Love, a film he made with Ellen Barkin, a cop thriller, that was an unexpected hit and it brought him back to people's attention, particularly Hollywood's attention. And he went back to LA, where he had not had a house up to that point, and started working on studio films. And one of them was Scent of a Woman, where he plays this blind ex-Marine who hires this young lad to take him to commit suicide. He's reached
Chris O'Donnell is playing the character.
Chris O'Donnell is the young lad, yeah. And Gabrielle Anwar is the love interest. And it again became this unexpected hit. And he found a second career as a studio stalwart, that he could make these kind of films quickly and easily, 3 or 4 of them a year, make some money and retain his kudos and retain his credibility.
Let's have a listen to him here as Lieutenant Colonel Frank Slade, as you say, blind. Chris O'Donnell is Charlie Sims, the student whose life is forever changed when he agrees to be Pacino's assistant in that great scene where he drives blind down the alley.
Yeah, yeah.
But here in this scene, we meet the romantic interest that you mentioned earlier on.
I'm Christine Downs, Colonel Slade. I teach political science. I just wanted to tell you how much I appreciate your coming here and speaking your mind.
Why, thank you. Are you married?
I
went to an artillery school at Fort Sill with a Mickey Downs. Thought he might have snagged you.
No, I'm afraid not.
Colonel Slade was on Lyndon Johnson's staff in those towns.
Were you? Fascinating.
We should get together, talk politics sometime.
Yeah.
Fleur de Rocaille.
Yes.
Flowers from a brook.
That's right.
Well, Miss Downs, I'll know where to find you. Charlie.
There we go. It's kind of romantic comedy in some ways. That's Al Pacino in Scent of a Woman. John McGuire with me in studio this evening talking about Sonny Boy, the new memoir from Al Pacino. So you get these kind of sweet movies in the midst of all the dark, street type movies that he made early on in the career. But one of the things I think that you've mentioned a couple of times, before I go back to the personal life, let me ask just something around the style of his acting. Is he in any way sensitive, when people start talking about chewing? Thank you for that. I didn't want to do it. And chewing the scenery, which he's well known to do the odd time.
Yeah, well, I think it's range is what's extraordinary. He's still always the same. He's still Al Pacino. He's a movie star. But he's got this kind of operatic, big, loud ball of dark energy, a dangerous energy. And he fizzes with this kind of life and he bursts with emotion. And that's one thing. But to be able to control that then and to direct it and point it in a certain way in character, I think that's his real skill. Energy is not rare. The ability to corral and control energy is what's magnetic. That's what makes you want to watch him. He talks a bit about that himself, about how exhausting it is to be Al Pacino, to work as Al Pacino, to be in character, and how difficult it is afterwards then to come back to real life.
That's interesting. So is he suggesting that there is a kind of
Al Pacino.
Like a Marilyn Monroe's thing.
There are characters throughout this. Bertolt Brecht turns up and gives him advice a couple of times as a ghost. Shakespeare is a kind of a character in this film. Cazal, who we mentioned earlier, he's a kind of a character in in this film. And there's all these kind of... In the memoir, excuse me. In the, not a film. It's a memoir. It's a book. But, you know, he seems to be floating through the time of his own life, if you know what I mean. He's got 50, 60-year span here, but it isn't necessarily chronological. And it tends to overlap and carry these kind of resonance from one part.
Yeah, you feel you're in a conversation with him.
I've
mentioned the interview I saw him where he spoke a little bit about the memoir, but he was very keen, in fact, on the day. He had a phone with him, mobile phone, and the cover on the phone, the little cradle to hold it, had Shrek on the back of it. And he had been given it by his child. Yeah. He has a very young child.
He's 2-year-old, yeah. Roman, with his now ex-girlfriend. He's got 4 children in total. But at 84, he has a 2-year-old, yeah. And you have a suspicion that the book is written necessarily because, you know, who's to say, but you have a suspicion that the book is written to get all of this down for a geriatric child at 84 years of age to have a newborn son, and that he needed to put it down in order to tell his own story.
So more that than because I mean it will fly off bookshelves.
It'll fly off the shelves, yeah. And you're always interested when you're reading these books that are co-written with an established writer. Whose voice are we really hearing? And I have to say that the balance here, the overwhelming balance is Pacino's. This is literally as it happened, as he experienced it, to the best of his recollection. There is a period when it gets very hazy and we really don't know what's going on, and neither does he. But, you know, it's, Javier Bardem's put it, I don't believe in God, I believe in Al Pacino. And I think, like I said, somehow if you'd never seen him, you'd know him from this book. And that's a real testimony to it. At 84 years of age, he's still working, he's still writing, he's still thinking about it.
Ringing endorsement. Was there anything in it that you thought, not that?
There is, actually. I'm very fond of a film called The Insider, a Michael Mann movie, and it's never mentioned. Now, he does mention Heat, and he does talk a bit about Michael Mann, but I think his performance in The Insider, later in his career, is really quite extraordinary. He's really quite brilliant.
You're
in
surprised
it.
That's
and
not
I,
there.
There are a few omissions. There's a few. Now, some of them, we can, 88 minutes, Righteous Kill, films that he made with De Niro, we don't need to hear about them, but there are some highlights later in his career that he just either doesn't get around to, or I would have been interested to read a bit more. But it's a minor complaint, Sean. This is a great book.
Yeah. Okay. Sounds like it could be one. Are we allowed to mention the December season? It sounds like it would be one.
Definitely.
For that,
if you're a fan, yeah, you have to read it.
All right. Sonny Boy is what John McGuire has been speaking about to us. It's the new memoir from Al Pacino, and it is published by Century. Your Own Dark Shadow is an anthology of lost Irish horror stories, edited and introduced by writer and researcher Jack Fennell. With Halloween almost upon us, the timing is perfect for this book, where killers, monsters and unquiet spirits abound. Drawn from the places where folklore, the gothic and modern fiction intertwine, the stories of this Your Own Dark Shadow celebrate Irish literature's dark and ever-present shadow. It will be launched during the Dublin Book Festival in November, and I'm delighted to be joined from our Limerick studio this evening by Jack Fennell. This is the interest that you have in this type of story is very clear from your introduction, Jack. Not least of which was you started out with that. Oftentimes the problem for an anthologist, there's too much stuff that I want to include. Yeah. What is it that attracts you to this type of horror story, specifically Irish horror story?
Well, I see it as a natural extension of just my interest in Irish storytelling. I mean, if you think about it, ghost stories and horror stories are like the oldest form of storytelling there is. Aside from that, I can't account for it, really.
Is there something specifically, though, about the Irish version of the horror story where it fits into our cultural life, where it fits into our cultural history?
I think so, because we're very, very good at preserving horror stories. I mean, that's why there was so much material that I wanted to include. It wasn't difficult to find at all. And I think it has something to do with the fact that our history has been punctuated by violent interruptions. You know, that the normal chain of causality of things is kind of interrupted every so often by something awful. And that has kind of leaked into our cultural memory. So we respond to these stories that are somewhat gruesome.
And to what extent do you think that the stories themselves are a response to, you know, terrible events, the famine being an obvious one in case, and a kind of a post-colonial hangover maybe into the 19th century?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you're talking about the famine, one of the stories in the book is The Lian on Shi by William Carleton. Mm. And William Carleton was around during the famine and he witnessed some awful things and he wrote fictionalized accounts of some of the horrible things that he saw. And The Lian on Shi, it's like a kind of an indistinct monster that he invents. It's like a parasite. It's attached to somebody and it's constantly demanding to be fed. You know, so you can kind of see some of his, you know, the unresolved issues from what he witnessed during the famine are processed in that.
And just give us the essence of what that story is. It's essentially a farmer's wife who takes it upon herself to deal with this Lian on Shi.
Well, it's about a farmer's wife who's kind of on her own in the house one day when this person knocks on the door and, like, there's a very suspicious lump on her back hidden by a cloak, and she's trying to get this farmer's wife to, you know, accept the bargain that ended up in that state of affairs, you know, because that's the only way to get rid of this thing is to persuade someone else to take over for you. And then, you know, things get very gothic and melodramatic from there when we find out this woman's history and what exactly led to the Lian on Shi attaching itself to her.
Yeah, and it is very dark stuff that we're dealing with for the most part. One of the things that struck me across several of the stories is that there's a lot of danger to be dabbling around and messing with the occult and all of that. So we have many cautionary tales here. I'm thinking, but to particular, I'm not sure how I should say it. Is it Diro Dirla by this a pseudonym JHK? Maybe for me anyway, many people may know, I don't. Who is JHK and tell us a bit more about the story?
I wish I could.
It's totally unknown, is it?
Totally unknown, which is interesting because, you know, I was aiming for gender parity with regard to the writers that we included. So it was handy to have that one person who could not be identified in the middle of it to sort of be there as the fulcrum. But yeah, Euro Yearla is based on it's quasi based on historical fact. Well, not historical fact, but like historical
characters are within it.
Yeah, exactly. Like the Earl Fitzgerald, who was supposed to have been a wizard back in the day. And, you know, the story is essentially recounting his interactions with disembodied voices in the dark and then letting his wife in on the secret of what he's learned from them to his own downfall.
And you're talking there about the gender balance. It was the difficulty in the gender balance, in fact, perhaps finding the men, because it was a genre that was quite common for women to write in.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And like, I'll hold my hands up like that, you know, it was kind of difficult to find male authors who hadn't been heard of before. Because that was the other...
This is part of the Recovered Voices series within Tramp Press.
Exactly, yeah. So it's all about stories that have been lost or haven't been anthologized very recently. And, you know, it was difficult finding male writers who kind of slipped through the cracks. Mm. All right. But you're absolutely right. I mean, this is a field in which women have traditionally excelled. You know, like women have written way more ghost and horror stories than men have, especially short fiction as well.
Yeah, one of the names that jumped out at me was a name that I think would be known, thanks to recent anthologies that have brought her back into the fore, Catherine Tynan. Tell us about her story in this.
Catherine Tynan, that's the Death Spancel, is it? Yes. The Death Spancel it's sort of like the dark inverted image of, you know, the love potion type story about, you know, like like casting a spell to bring your true love to you, and it kind of examines it from, you know, a very objective kind of view, that that is not a terribly nice thing to do to another human being. And the means by which she does it is spectacularly gruesome. It involves the skin of a cadaver, like woven into a belt, essentially. And, you know, this is how you get someone to stay with you. It's a very short story, but very effective. Like, I mean, I was very disturbed when I read it myself.
It did strike me that there are several stories within the book where the atmosphere is as important almost as the story itself, although they all have quite a strong narrative drive. There are a number of stories. Is it two stories that are translated from Irish?
Yes. So there's one by Micheál MacLiomore called Angus O'Cruilley, which it's written in the old Irish spelling, so there's DHs the whole way through it, but that's how it's pronounced. And when you hear it kind of read out, it becomes clear that he's making a play on Aleister Crowley, right? It's like an Irish version of Aleister Crowley.
And Aleister Crowley being?
Aleister Crowley being the self-proclaimed wickedest man in the world. he was a magician. He founded the Order of the Golden Dawn, among other occult societies. Got into a bit of a scrap with W.B. Yeats at one of the Golden Dawn meetings. Yeats, by all accounts, kicked him down a flight of stairs. A very interesting man.
And the other story that is translated from the Irish is The Third Woman by Tomás Baréd, which I think is one of your favourites within the anthology.
Oh, it is. It is. I absolutely love that story. It's very kind of timeless in it, at the same time modern. You know, it's about these two girls. They go on a road trip through the Midlands. The car breaks down in the middle of nowhere. They can't get it going again. They see a light on in a distant farmhouse. They go up there to ask if they can spend the night. And when they knock on the door, it becomes clear to the reader that they're after interrupting something inside that house. There's a whole bunch of people in there wearing cloaks, and there's stacks of candles and what have you. And sort of oblivious to what they're getting themselves into, they accept a night in this house, or they accept a bed in this room for the night, and they discover what has been going on. Just before they interrupted it.
Yeah, and you do have to say, don't go into the house. Yeah. But of course, there's no story if they don't go into the house.
Exactly.
What does the, I think, did you translate the Irish language stories yourself in this case?
I did, yeah.
What is it about the Irish language? Does it add a different atmosphere? Does it add a different quality to the stories?
Well, like, I mean, there is in Irish writing, especially of that era, like there is this tendency to kind of lather on adjectives, right? Which is something you're not supposed to do in English at all. It gets called purple prose, but it is like an accepted part of Irish prose writing. So you can kind of come across these sentences where there's like seven or eight adjectives kind of compounding the effect of what you're supposed to be imagining. And, you know, when you translate that into English, you do have to pare it down and streamline it, because it doesn't have the same effect. But reading it in the original Irish, like, there are parts of it that are almost hallucinatory.
And I wondered if that was that the same case for you. Now, this isn't in the book. This is a kind of related to your translating work. But you translated the early work of Flann O'Brien from Irish to English as well, didn't you?
I did, yeah.
Gaeltacht Ar Gaillimh's Saveleen 2032, Revenge of the English in the year 2032. Proving that Flann O'Brien, or Brian O'Nolan, I think he was writing as there, was actually a science fiction writer as well.
He was, yeah. And there was an expression that says, like, good science fiction doesn't just predict the automobile, it predicts the traffic jam. And he predicted an Irish-speaking future Ireland, but he also predicted that it would be a commonplace practical joke to teach people Irish phrases, which are actually really, really filthy. and telling them that it's just asking for directions.
Yeah, so we have the Irish language within Flann O'Brien, we have the Irish language in two of the stories, and in fact we'll be talking about an Irish language horror film a little bit later in the programme as well. horror seems to be having a moment, I think it's fairly safe to say, right now, Jack.
Yeah.
What do you put that down? What do you think it is? Or is it just that it changes? It's never really gone away?
Well, it's tempting to kind of say that, oh, it's because of the historical moment and everything seems to be chaotic and dangerous and scary at the moment. But, you know, when you look at it, like, every historical moment has kind of thought that about itself. You know, like back in the 80s, there was the threat of nuclear war, for example. I would say that there is an extent to which it has never gone away. It's just been lurking there in the background, and it just kind of surfaces and becomes more relevant at certain key points. I don't know if I'm explaining that properly. But
so you think it's the whatever's happening in the present moment, sometimes horror is just suitable for it to... Maybe that we're experiencing fear and anxiety, so therefore we go to something where fear and anxiety are present to kind of face it down.
Yeah, that's basically it. And, you know, that there's a theory that when there's a Republican in the White House in America, zombie movies become really popular. And when there's a Democrat in the White House, vampire movies make a resurgence. You know, make of that what you will.
Somebody's PhD thesis is now starting. you have edited three of the different the anthologies for Tramp Press about these recovered voices. You refer to them as the weird sisters of storytelling.
Yes.
Sci-fi, horror and fantasy.
Yep.
Are we good at the genre writing, or is it the Irish in particular?
Oh, I think we are. I think we're very good at it. The strange thing is, though, that, you know, once upon a time we were renowned for, you know, fairy tales and gothic fiction and what have you. And then during the 20th century, we sort of backed away from that. We sort of cringed at it. It was kind of too much of a throwback to the days of the Gullible Paddy, sort of. But then, you know, later on in the 20th century, it started to come back in bits and bobs. And, like, now you can't move in Ireland for horror writers and sci-fi writers and fantasy writers. It's great. It's really having a moment.
That is for sure. Thanks so much for joining us from Limerick this evening, Jack.
Thank you very much for having me, Sean.
That's Jack Fennell and his anthology, Your Own Dark Shadow, is published by Tramp Press. It will be launched at the Gutter Bookshop on the 8th of November as part of the Dublin Book Festival. Of course, we have our own Dublin Book Festival event to look forward to too. Wednesday, November the 6th, we will host a winter paper special at the Windmill Quarters, a live programme with Kevin Barry, author of Night Boat to Tangier, The Heart in Winter, and co-editor of Winter Papers, along with a panel of contributors that include poet Fiona Grork, authors Angela Flannery, Alice Lyons and Paulina Cosgrave. There'll also be live music from Paul Noonan and Dahi O'Droney, also known as Houseplants. And if you're not coming along in person, you're invited to join us here on RTE Radio 1 on that Wednesday, 6th of November. On Taivsha, The Ghost is the first Irish language horror film directed by filmmaker John Farley and executive produced by six-time Oscar nominee Jim Sheridan. Amid the barren landscape of post-famine Ireland, a father and daughter struggle to survive the brutal winter as caretakers of a remote mansion, only to be driven down the brink of insanity by the horrors lurking within. On Taivsha will be shown this weekend as part of the Horrorthon at IFI at the Irish Film Institute in Dublin. Delighted to be joined by director John Farley on the line from Los Angeles right now. John, you won't have heard our previous item, which was all about a collection of forgotten Irish horror stories. So the horror is making a big show on the programme this evening. On Taivsha, it's in the Irish language, but before we get stuck into why you wanted to do that, the father and daughter dynamic that is told here in post-famine Ireland, that story, what was the sparking or the seed point of that?
Well, thanks for having me on. It was... I wanted to explore certain subject. Like related to a father and daughter relationship, and I thought by doing it as a ghost story, it would work best with the whole metaphor of the past haunting the present.
And this idea too of we're in post-famine Ireland, I think that historical setting is very important to you and important to the story.
Yeah, no, definitely. That's why we chose to set it at that time, because from the famine, it created like a chain reaction of trauma being passed on, that transgenerational trauma being passed on generations, and a lot of it began famine. So, we wanted to set it during that time for that reason.
Yeah. The father and daughter in question here, played by Tom Thirsk and Livy Hill, you had known both of them, I think, for a while.
Yeah, so I'd worked with Tom before on different films, and I'd worked with Liv before as well. And Liv went to college with me in Ulster University in Derry. So we met there and we'd collaborate together on different short films, and they're both great. And even Anthony Murphy, who's also in the film, we'd also collaborated. So we had already established a relationship and a great connection. So it was easy whenever I'd finished the script, I knew, yeah, these are the ones.
These are my people. Why the Irish language? How quickly did that become an issue within the telling of the story, or an important part of the telling of the story for you, John?
Yeah, no, from the get-go, I wanted to make it in the Irish language for different reasons. One being, I think it's important that we make our in the Irish language. And, you know, it's our language, it's our culture. And I think it's great to see more and more films being made in the Irish language. And then also, I wanted to keep it true and authentic to the time period. I felt that having it in the Irish language, it would make the story more immersive for the audience, because you're transported back in time and seeing how they actually spoke. So, yeah, it was between those two different reasons.
And did you write it in Irish, or did you write it in English and then get help with the translating out of it? How did that work?
Yeah, so we wrote it in English initially and then translated it to Irish. I went to an all-Irish primary school and then stopped speaking it, and then my Irish slowly disimproved. But then it's, you know, great thing about this project, working on it, Rebecca Monaghan, who helped with the Irish translations as well, we worked together on that and making sure we had the correct Irish, the best Irish for the story.
Yeah, and you've certainly given it an Ulster Irish dialect. Even though I'm hearing a bit of a northern accent in your voice right now, you're not originally, you're originally from down, is it in and around Clare?
No, I'm originally from Drogheda.
Oh, I beg your pardon.
And then I moved up to the north when I was about 12, 13, so a bit of a half and half accent.
Ah, yeah, well, Drogheda and then up the north, you're quite definitely going to have a northern accent. I'm going to listen to a little clip, a section from the film, John, all us Gaeilge here, and it is the father and daughter. Livy Hill is the daughter, and Tom Thirsk as the father. They're sitting at the table, so they're not long in this deserted house where they're kind of fixing things up for the big family to come down eventually, and the father's be saying, it might get better. But Livy, as you will hear, as Moira, the character of Moira, is very keen that they just make a bit of money and get back up to her friends in Belfast.
Mab tamoid albata galor aragida ve salbucha gin. Is fedrin buggy arash gumma fersha? Mushin kyar?
Ne landlord and chin doing me some more about it.
Kaje fui maharja. Agus the nyerum. Agus anish taradi chacked arash in a yart arish. Veo me albata del arash a skull.
Of course, the Ara Habar. Near Aki Sherash. He says, Shamarata Shanish. Jirok, under the Stavaka. Naga Willemid Biovak, August the Fallak Hill.
That's Tom Thirsk and Livy Hill in a scene from On Taibhse. The ghost and writer and director of this Irish language horror film, John Farley, is with me on the line this evening. Extraordinary in the midst of all of that, as I was listening and watching the film today, John, I was kind of marvelling at Livy's facility with particularly Gaeilge Ullu, Ulster Irish that she's speaking there. She had no Irish at all. This is all learned phonetically, which is kind of extraordinary because it doesn't sound like that at all.
Yeah, no. She did an amazing job, because I said to her, look, would you do it in Irish? So actually, originally it was meant to be a short film. And I was like, look, you'll be able to learn a few lines phonetically. And she was like, yeah. So we made a short film, and then we were like really happy with the result, but it was a feature film being squeezed into a short film, so it just didn't really work. Yeah. So we said, you know what, let's go back and make the feature. And then Liv, like, credit to her, like, did an amazing job learning all of her lines phonetically. Sure.
And you managed to get Jim Sheridan on as executive producer. How important was that, and what did it give to the film? What did it add?
Yeah, so I was fortunate enough to meet Jim just after we'd shot the film. So I had a rough cut. It was about 2 hours. And I said, this film would have a look. He watched it and he really liked it. But then he had a few notes for it. So he was like, oh, cut this, get it down to 90 minutes, take that out, reshoot that. So then we made some changes, and then he agreed to come on board as executive producer, and just was a great mentor and great help for shaping the film and the story in the right direction.
Your location is extraordinary here, Colatin House in County Wicklow. I mean, perfect for the story you're telling, a rundown house that needs to be done up, and this father and daughter arrived down to do just that. And I believe you were isolated and in the woods shooting in winter, so you weren't pretending to be cold. The actors weren't pretending to be cold on stage.
No, not at all. Whenever you see their breaths and like the cold air, like, and the snow, that's all real. And even we'd scheduled an exterior day to film like all the outside scenes. That was the one day it snowed. But our plan, we bought loads of salt in Tesco, and then we were going to green screen the grass, because it's green, to white, and then do that whole, like, just make it look like it's in the middle of winter. But luckily, the day we planned to shoot outside, it snowed, so that worked in our favour. But yeah, for the actors and even ourselves, being in this remote location with, you know, no phone service, no Wi-Fi, and just immersing ourselves in that world, it really helped. Myself work on the film, like get into the director mode of where I want, like shooting the film, and then for the actors as well to immerse them into that world. Like, it was easy just to get into character.
Well, I hope you kept the receipts for the salt and could go back and return it and get your money back. Don't know if you managed that one or not.
Yeah, no, I'm still using that salt now. It's all in one big cupboard.
You won't need any salt for a long, long time. Yeah. All right, yeah. John, thanks for being with us this evening. Gormagot das Vetling.
Gormagot slán.
That's it, John Farley. And John's film On Tive Show will be playing in the IFI, the Irish Film Institute in Dublin, as part of the IFI Horrorthon. And that is on October the 26th. The screening will be followed by a Q&A with John and cast members. Full details at ifi.ie. That is our lot for this Tuesday evening. Leah Murphy researched. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Back with you tomorrow, 7 o'clock, here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.